to the third discussion session. This is probably the most speculative one of the ones we had so far. Sorry, not so much about what we already have, but more about what we would like to have. Maybe somehow a more fundamental theory that, in some limit, whatever that might be, reproduces known physics, including general relativity in some limit, quantum theory, quantum mechanics, and that also reproduces the symmetries that we are all familiar with. Or also concepts such as locality, unitarity, causality, and so on. And I guess beyond the fact that we all agree that we should somehow get this, probably there's a lot of disagreement or possible disagreement on how one should get there and what should be the fundamental ingredients of such an approach, whether it should be information-based or string theory-based or cellular automaton-based or some other approach to quantum gravity. And yeah, so this discussion session will be about sharing ideas on this. And of course, the audience is invited to intervene and also give their comments. So I think I will start now with the youngest of the group here.
Okay, so I didn't know that it was that we were supposed to express our wishes, what we wanted to have. Let me say where I come from. What motivates me? Since I come from a background of quantum gravity, or a theory, which is the theory that you described, or which is a name to give to the theory, to the more fundamental theory that you describe, that should have general relativity in some limit and quantum physics as we know it, in at least give us the experience of that in some limit. That is what is motivating me. What I would like to have is of course such a theory. I have to honestly say you just said that we would probably disagree. I don't think I would disagree with any serious proposal, because I see this as learning from failure, and what I mean with that is we have we search for quantum gravity forces us to think about the foundations of gravity, so whether space-time is fundamental, whether geometry is fundamental or emergent, how it is emergent, how if space-time is not fundamental, how if something like causality is not fundamental but an emergent structure, how can we reconcile that with known physics, which is constant, where causality, our formulation of quantum field theories is strictly tied to causality, so how could we do that? Also, the foundations of quantum mechanics itself you have to think about that when you don't have space-time, and if space-time is only built up is only a phenomenon that appears in a certain limit of a more fundamental theory, and also this is where the theme of the conference comes in. We have to think about information, because Ariel was saying it this morning in his talk. On one of the first slides, you were saying physics is a. There are two ways of looking at physics. One is that a physical model models nature, and the other, and I probably misquote you now, but you may correct me, is that physics is about how we update our information about nature. And this is really the stance that I take, that we have this bottleneck, which is a limited amount of information that we can get out of nature, a limited amount of reliable information that we can get out of nature. And through this bottleneck, we want to constrain a model behind that. There may be, and this is why I'm deliberately agnostic about anybody else's proposal, whether I agree or reject whether I agree with it or reject it. I want to learn from other from proposals, because we only have this bottleneck. There may be many ontological theories behind there that when you see it through the limitations that are inherent in our way of doing science, give you the same answers. And so I'm excited. I've now taken part in almost 3 days of discussions over coffee with people, and I'm excited about being exposed to new ideas, being challenged, being taken out of my comfort zone. And so I think that's enough for introductory remarks, and I can give back to Philip.
Are there any comments from the audience on this?
So I didn't offend anyone. I should have done that.
No, you have been you have been very pragmatic and embracing everyone.
That was probably not the best thing to get a discussion started.
Okay. Then maybe we move on with the next speaker.
Maybe I will provoke a bit more discussion. Let's see. So it's first of all, I'm very happy to be here, and also for me it's new to learn many of these information theoretic approaches and ideas. And my general view on information theory, maybe let me begin with that, is of course there's a lot of information in the universe, and we all have a lot of information. And information theory should be able to bring all this into a better context and to understand better what the underlying structures are. So therefore, my impression is that information theory is very good and promising in any case, no matter what specific ideas from the potential, no matter what your physical ideas on how space-time comes up and all this are. Now, concerning emergence of space-time, my impression is that one should be more specific. So one should really say, like, what is the mathematical framework in which one wants to describe, like, quantum gravity, in which space-time emerges, and so on. I mean, a bit similar as in quantum mechanics, where one writes down, okay, one has a Hilbert space and self-adjoint operators, and so on. And then within this framework, it is one can describe quantum mechanics. Now, of course, now we need a different framework, and to me, the challenge is really to find what the correct framework is. And more specifically, the main difficulty from my point of view is, like, to find how to formulate the physical equation. I mean, like, if you give up classical space-time, like a space-time manifold, then most of the usual, like, operators you can no longer write down. You don't know what difference quotients, derivatives are, and so on. So therefore, one has to find the correct physical language for writing down physical equations, which then have the potential to describe physics. And to me, it's not sufficient just to generalize the known notions. I'm making everything, in particular in mathematics, one can do everything more. So I come from mathematics, so everything can be generalized and so on. But I think this is not sufficient. One has to really be more specific and come up with a new mathematical model, with a new type of equations, which then have the potential for really making progress. And I should say, I would wish that there were many proposals of this type, so that we could really, like, compare them and see, okay, this works here, this doesn't work here. And so this would also be good for the discussion if there were many different proposals. And of course, there are a few proposals, and of course, there are also proponents of these different proposals here. So, and of course, maybe I should also say something to the approach which I will present tomorrow, these causal fermion systems. So, I mean, I came up with this after thinking about such questions of how could one formulate equations and so on for quite a long time. So this is, like, what I came up with. And there really one has a framework where one does not start with space-time from the beginning, but one can write down physical equation formulated in terms of an action principle. And if you take a minimizer of this action principle, then this gives rise to space-time, causal structure, wave functions, And in certain limiting cases, an interaction via gauge fields like classical gravity or even quantum field theory. I mean, I don't claim that this is really like how to do it, but this is like my proposal, and I would like to see other proposals so that we can compare, and hopefully eventually one of these proposals will survive and will really bring us ahead.
Any comments from the audience on this? So then maybe I should become a bit more specific. So in your case, causality is a fundamental ingredient of your approach.
And, not quite. I mean, this also, causality also emerges.
Also emerges.
So this action principle is called causal-action principle because it's kind of, so this action principle is closely tied to causality in the sense, maybe just this is a little bit oversimplified, but nevertheless, let me state it like this, so that this action principle tries to make as many pairs of points space-like separation as possible. But on the other hand, they are constrained, which make it impossible that all pairs of points are space-like. And this gives like a kind of interesting competing effects, which lead to like a non-trivial causal structure for the minimum. So this is kind of how it works. So causality really is emergent and is inherent in the structure of a causal fermion system.
Okay, thanks. Maybe I can also ask you a bit about causality, because you've been working on the shape dynamics approach and the question of causality in shape dynamics, or also when you think about the particle model. Do you have any comments on that?
Much of this is now almost inaudible right here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Perhaps you can move closer.
Does that apply to what you've heard from everyone or just from me?
Everyone.
So,
we can.
Fine.
I think it's fine.
Okay, so we should speak up a bit. So, or maybe you can also comment on causality.
Okay, so, yes, so you're asking a specific question. about causality in shape dynamics. So a priori, there is no fixed notion of causality. There is also, as there is in any dynamical approach to, if you describe gravity, in classical gravity as a dynamical system, it's causality is hidden in the initial data, but it's not. It's something that you get by integrating the equations of motion. And it's a very simply stated, it emerges like that in shape dynamics. More concretely, what you have to do is you have to experience causality, and with that I mean you look at how matter evolves together with gravity, or any degree of freedom. You could think about weak gravitational waves also. They would also do that. But how light matter evolves with the shape dynamics description of gravity gives you at first something that is a limit for the characteristics of evolution. And then you integrate that and you see these limits are precisely what you would get as the light cone in a space-time description of gravity, and in fact in most cases they coincide with these light cones. So that is how it emerges. It's not a fundamental ingredient, it is something that comes out of solving the equation. But it's also not surprising the way in which it comes out. It's rather straightforward. But it is, of course, orthogonal to, because Raphael Sorkin is sitting here, to approaches to quantum gravity that take causality as the fundamental building block. I mean, the idea that a locally finite partial ordered set describes space-time, which is Raphael's proposal, takes causality as the fundamental ingredient and everything else as emergent. in the approach that I described. It's just the opposite, and it's good to learn from what you gain and what you lose from which side you attack the problem.
Yeah, you should look at Gerard when you say that too, although it's not his current direction, as we heard.
Yeah, I guess another good example for causality playing a vital role in a quantum gravity model is probably causal dynamic triangulations, where if you just take the usual Euclidean dynamic triangulations, then it doesn't really give you any four-dimensional geometries, even if you start out with four-dimensional building blocks. But if you introduce causality or causal or space-times with a foliation that have a notion of time, then you actually get some sort of four-dimensional limit that looks a bit like GR. Okay, I see there's no questions or comments from the audience. I think Stephen Weinstein was first, and then Zilke.
It occurs to me that causality is being used differently by different people. So, what you were just talking about is the emergence, causality emerges in the sense that light cones emerge.
Because
this is a sort of correlational structure of a space.
Yes, it's the inference that.
Let me just finish with that, because I don't have that much to say. But so I'll just finish saying. So that's a kind of a causality that doesn't have there's no particular causal arrow in there. We've heard other approaches. I think Raphael's approach. I know in Lucian's approach, there's a specific arrow of time built in, and then causality is supposed to go from the present to the future, one direction. And it's not clear if you have that approach, what sense a bidirectional, time reversal invariant theory is going to emerge. So this is just a point, and maybe you guys can speak to it. When we're talking about the emergence of causality, it's not clear that we're talking about a single thing. So the causality in one sense might emerge from another theory, but some other sense of causality might not. And maybe you can take that up.
Can I comment on that? I think we should.
Of course.
I don't know that I need the microphone. I think we should learn from philosophers to distinguish between causality and causation, which is a way to put the distinction you're trying to make, perhaps.
And correlation too. I mean, that's what I was thinking about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But I mean, it's very difficult for me to imagine that causation emerges because it's fundamental to explanation, to all the different kinds of explanations that we're talking about. Nothing is emerging in just the fact that you have to solve equations of motion to reconstruct a space line doesn't mean that causation isn't fundamental. You just have a mathematical procedure to describe the effects of causation, but causation is non-emergent and fundamental. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother to solve the equation.
Let me just answer your question in the context of causal fermion systems. So that is that what you get is like first of all the distinction between time-like and space-like, and the distinction of future and past. But it's not the way that like the dynamics only goes into the future, not in the past.
So that's
about causality. I would be very much opposed against giving up a primary notion of causality. We must have some form of causality. Let me explain this. I have a definition of both causality and the concept of time, which come together in the sense that whatever theory of nature one can come up with, think of anything even remotely different from anything like our present universe. You have some sort of laws of nature that you have figured out, however. Then you write down what those laws of nature actually are. They are in textbooks and so on. Somewhere in the textbook, there must be a statement that tells you in which order you should apply the equations. Because you would say, a planet is now here. 1 second after that, the planet will be there. And where exactly the planet will be and what its velocity will be, you can now calculate. But however, the book should say which calculations you should do first. Do you first want to know where the moon of the planet is going, and then the planet itself, or should you calculate it in the other order? For sure, the outcome of the calculation will depend on that order. So you must have a given order in which to do the calculation, and that order is my definition of time. So the textbook tells you, whether you like it or not, there is something that you could call time, which simply tells you that at every moment in time you apply equations. If you do it in the wrong order, you get the wrong answer. And that, to me, together with time, defines causality. Now, for some strange reason, in our universe, that time coordinate happens to coincide with Minkowski time. Now, that does not necessarily have to be the case. I could imagine a world, not like the world I know today, but some crazy world, where the actual causal time variable is something else. But there must be some variable that is time. In our experience, that happens to coincide with Minkowski time. So most likely, in a future theory, either time, causal time, is identical to Minkowski time, or it is closely related. There might be some deviations every now and then. That is fine. But you must have some causal order of things. Otherwise, you don't know how to apply the laws of physics. You've discovered everything except the order in which you apply the equations. You haven't got things right yet. The danger is, of course, if you have a closed time-like loop. That means that your book is a circular book. It doesn't tell you where to begin the loop and where to end the loop. Then your book is wrong. Your book doesn't give the complete laws. You know very well, if you have circular time, you have a difficulty waiting for you. Either way, you're not only can you kill your grandfather, but there's much more basic difficulties there. So even the science fiction book about somebody who went back in time and killed his grandfather, even that science fiction book has a beginning and an end. So then, okay, the close thing that you call time wasn't time, but the beginning of the book and the end of the book, that was the time variable. There's no way you can avoid that.
Yeah, does anybody want to take up on this?
We'll probably ask him.
I think this is a very important thing to say, because there's a lot of foolish talk coming from the quantum gravity community, which I used to participate in. I mean the talk, not the community. That about time emerging from a timeless world. And I agree with Gerard, it's foolish. I would put what Gerard said slightly differently, but to emphasize the same point. Time in the sense of causation is non-emergent. In fact, it's the least emergent part of the world that we're well acquainted with. Space-time may be emergent in the sense of embedding of events in an emergent description in terms of some continuous Minkowski and space-time. Locality, space, I'm happy with being emergent. Locality is emergent. Locality, if the distinction between local and non-local is emergent, so is probably quantum mechanics. Fields are emergent. Many things are emergent, but time and causation have to be fundamental to nature, I believe.
So I think we give the audience a chance to intervene. I think Silke was the next one.
So I just picked up, I have a little call. But so one of the things which I find quite intriguing about shape dynamics is the fact that you have a preferred time, but you only have spin two propagating degrees of freedom because you invoke another symmetry. So I wonder if that is accidental. I mean, is there some, to be honest, usually when you have a preferred time or foliation, you get extra propagating degrees of freedom. And it seems to me, I was very surprised when I heard about that theory that doesn't have these problems. So is shape dynamic, shape symmetry, does it have something to do with that? Is it accidental? Is there another way of killing the lower propagating degrees of freedom except of the spin two?
Well, I mean, there may be other ways other than spatial conformal symmetry. I mean, if you're just worried about counting the local propagating degrees of freedom, you need some new symmetry once you've given up relativity of time, relativity of simultaneity as a fundamental symmetry. You have to have a symmetry that kills one of these three remaining. One of the 3 degrees of freedom of the local geometry of a 3-dimensional geometry. So spatial conformal symmetry is one way to do that. But maybe if you have a different description of geometry, you may come up with a different symmetry principle altogether that also kills, that gets the numbers of degrees of freedom right at the end. But I don't know if it is. Maybe are there other panelists that have proposals?
There was one thing I wanted to say for inventions, time, but also with what you are saying. There was one thing I forgot to mention. You would think of more advanced books of nature, so not a primitive question like in which order should you apply the laws, but you can also ask, are there laws which I can apply in either order, and the order doesn't matter? If you have such laws also in your textbook, and that's quite possible, then you get the notion of space like separated. So now you have also events which are such that they are outside each other's light curve. So this means if you do this kind of thing, then you need a time variable that's where also you have light cones, and you can be inside or outside the light cone, both in the future and in the past. So now you get something that looks much more like Minkowski's space-time. That would mean that this Minkowski's space-time would not really be emergent, but would be fundamental. And it would have fundamental light cones. And that brings me to conformal symmetry. If you ask, what's so special about Minkowski space? Well, the light cones are very special. The thing that is much less special is the parameter in the metric which defines the sizes of things, the conformal factor. So that space and time without conformal factor, so which can be arbitrary, which would be a conformally invariant space-time, that would be more basic than the tenth component of the metric tensor, which defines distances and time scales. So that tenth component, as far as I'm concerned, is much easier to imagine to be emergent. Whereas the rest of the metric sounds more familiar, more fundamental to me, although you might negotiate about where exactly the light cone should be. So how fundamental the metric tensor is, I don't know. But so that could be emergent. There are degrees of acceptance of various theories of emergence of space-time. So because I think light cones are important, I would also say think that locality will be important. So next step is, will locality be emergent? There's various people saying, we don't care about locality, throw it away and try over there. It's not that easy, but then you can't have space-like separated events anymore, or at least not so easily. And so I would be very hesitant to throw away locality. So in that respect, I'm very conservative.
Just because I'm getting bored up here, I haven't said anything yet. I don't have answers for you, but I'll just put forth that, you know, I've actually been really excited by all of the inspiring talks this week, but in some sense I'm fortunate in that I'm not exploring to find a new theory, but I've been given a mathematical framework to play with. Namely holography or ADS-CFT. And one of the things that one of the pleasures of working there is that it's always a surprise that it's never the way, or things are never quite the way that you want or the way that you expected. And so, you know, an example of that, or I can turn to either Lee or Gerard, where you said that you couldn't give up on time. And ADS-CFT is sort of an example where you don't give up on time, but then you don't keep it entirely either, in that, you know, you have one description where it is a very simple, or quote-unquote simple theory. It's a quantum field theory. There's a very rigid structure there. It's actually a conformal structure. I've got light cones, I've got causality. But then there's another language where you're describing the same physics. You know, we tend to work in one particular corner of parameter space where, you know, it is, again, imposing a relatively rigid structure with light cones and causality. But as Steve was hinting yesterday, that, you know, you can go beyond that. And we're not very good at it yet. But one expects that things like in the bulk causality isn't a given, locality isn't a given. And so it's a framework where you could explore these ideas. We haven't, you know, gotten very far past a very simple understanding, but it's something where surprises may emerge. Certainly, if you asked me what I'd be doing, you know, 5-10 years ago, I would have gotten it completely wrong. And so, you know, if you ask me what we're going to find 5 years from now, I don't know either. But I know that Eric has also been silent, and this is something he thinks about. So
I'll
see.
Go through. Yeah, I also come from the string theory background, and certainly the questions we've been talking about here are very important conceptual questions that also appear in studies of black holes and so on. I think those hints that we have in thinking about such situations, like Gerard actually started a long time ago, I mean, they give important clues about what could eventually be the theory we are looking for. And indeed, as Rob just said, we have in string theory a mathematical framework where certain things are already happening. We have already seen things like emergent space-times in certain situations, but we don't understand fully the entire, what is the right language. And the new connection with quantum information, I think, is a very promising one. I mean, there we start indeed addressing more of the conceptual questions also. But I don't think it's right to sort of ignore even all of the hints that we have already. And I think I indeed see it also as a challenge to see, get eventually to the right language where we can understand what is emergence of space-time, but then check it also what we know already about string theory, for instance. And indeed, ADS-CFT is an example where many things have worked already very wonderfully. And whatever description we're going to find, it has to be consistent with it. I really think there is no other description eventually than the things that will eventually also be at least, string theory might be an example of it. Maybe there's another way of arriving at the same kind of description. But I think that working with a model, I mean, this was indeed proposed, but we have to work with some precise mathematical framework. And string theory does give a very precise way of doing things. So. I really would like to say that ignoring the successes that string theory has, I don't think is a very wise approach in trying to get to this this theory. I mean, also with the questions about causality and locality, indeed, there are many things we don't fully understand, but it's not like we're going to guess it by not having some more larger framework and more checks. Which we can do on the mathematical consistency of what we're thinking about. I think as humans, we're not very good in thinking about a theory just from scratch. I don't think we are.
I agree. One of the conclusions I draw from the results of string theory, especially matrix models, is that the BFSS matrix model, the Yang-Mills light cone gauge matrix model that you've worked on, is much more powerful than the KKLT matrix model where one attempts to get space-time to emerge as well. And for me, that's a piece of evidence that keeping time non-emergent and letting everything else emerge might be a right direction.
Yeah, I must admit that emergence of space, I think most people are more familiar and more happy with than the emergence of time. And this has to do indeed with the thing you're saying. It's very hard to think about causality, and I don't fully understand the definition of causation. Maybe you have to explain this, but I kind of understand there's order of cause and effect, which is the kind of thing you want to be clear about. But maybe some of this is tautological in the sense that you might either say we have to assume space-time because we need locality and causality, but maybe space-time is just a representation of the causal relations that we have, which is sort of the approach that you're taking. But I think there is maybe eventually a much larger set of, if we indeed think that space-time is a special state of the entire theory, maybe only certain states have that property, and there may be many states that don't look like space-time. In that sense, then space-time would not be a fundamental part of the laws of nature. And then we should think about how it emerges in certain situations. And somehow I think that that is sort of the way that string theory seems to work. I mean, I do think that in string theory we can make situations where a space-time picture is not even that clear that it exists. I mean, where we can meet loose notions about space-time, like this recent firewall paradox was clearly there. We start doubting the existence of space-time behind a horizon. I mean, and maybe this is indeed a larger framework we have to be working in than having something that already is putting the locality of space-time right from the beginning into the picture.
Can I just throw something in?
Yeah.
And in the case of causal sets, it's possible to quantify to what extent causal sets that resemble a space-time are special compared to the rest, and they're very, very special. It's more than an exponentially small fraction that looks like a space-time manifold.
So, I would like to make a comment about what Eric said about self-consistency, mathematical self-consistency, in the context of the closed-timing curves that Jared mentioned. So, and if you would just consider mathematical self-consistency, then solutions in general relativity, which are closed-timing curves, are completely consistent. You never end up with you killing your own father or your grandfather or whatever, because they have to be completely mathematically consistent. So there is no way of escaping the loop. The full solution is this closed-timer curve, and which will be forever in. But there is no action that you could make that would make you feel that it's inconsistent, because you have to be in this solution. I mean, the only you have to put in by hand somehow that you don't like this kind of closed-timer curves and you don't consider them. And the only reason for that is because you want to have some kind of, I don't know, Hamiltonian evolution. Well-defined Cauchy evolution, which doesn't exist in this kind of not globally hyperbolic space times. But I don't think from pure mathematical consistency of general relativity you can somehow get out of closed time curves. Maybe.
Well, yeah, part of the framework.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it's not something that mathematical consistency is enough to get rid of.
But there are solutions such as the Kerr-Newton solution of the very have this example where you have closed time curves in the solution just coming out of nowhere. But to my mind, that's a fundamental difference between mathematics and physics. In mathematics, you don't care in which closed loop you end up to. But sometimes mathematicians discover that there's some undecidedness or some inconsistency in the mathematics. I think this is exactly the reason. But it's always forbidden to use circular arguments. In mathematics, they love doing that because this way you can get more powerful theorems. Otherwise, the arguments why prime numbers are empty. Well, you imagine, that argument is a circular argument, but in practice, it solves a problem. But in mathematics, every now and then you end up in problems where you don't find an answer. And to my mind, the explanation is that they've been using circular arguments just one too many, and then you get into great difficulties. So with the Kerr-Newton solution, if you have any object moving into a Kerr-Newton solution, if an object comes close to a closed-time curve, it might run into a contradiction. Fortunately, that closed-time curve is far away behind the horizon, so it never affects physics outside that Kerr-Newton, where everything is still prime. And that seems to hold, as far as we know, everywhere in general relativity, there's this cosmic censorship, which may be difficult to prove, but I think in a good theory of nature, there will be some version of cosmic censorship that tells you it's really forbidden, you will never get those time occurs. If you get them, there will be a special law of nature that will have to wait there to be applied only in the case that something goes wrong with your other argument. You have to say what happens when I meet my own grandfather and I'm just about to kill him. What should I do? And there should be a law of nature that tells you what I should do in such circumstances. Otherwise, the law book of nature is incomplete. So what mathematicians do is their own responsibility. And so they can. So I think the two answers are these.
these horizons where you have closed time occurs are actually unstable against perturbation and things like this. This is what usually
unstable and not generic. Is it, yes. Raphael remembers the theorem of Heisenberg or Moncrief that closed time occurs require these one killing factors.
At least one killing factor?
Yeah, and if you interpret they are unstable.
There are, well, I was going to, yeah, I don't remember that. I'm not sure that I can place it right now, what you're referring to, but I was going to mention a something of a similar nature, which is a kind of inconsistency that arises in closed time like this. It goes by the name of, generally by chronology protection, conjecture or theorem, depending on the status of it. And it's very hard to take something which has closed time-like curves forever, eternal closed time-like curves, and decide whether or not it's consistent physically or not consistent. That was the example.
Okay.
But
these special simple solutions in lower dimensions of the universe which have this closed time curve coming out of nowhere.
Right, but the question that people have been able to address better is, suppose I start with a space-time that has no closed-time-like curves, and then it develops closed-time-like curves. Is that consistent?
How can that be?
So, I can give you a good, there's a very cute example. If you could make so-called wormholes, that is, topological connections between one region of space-time and another, that you could go directly, you know, through this hand, well, people call it wormhole. You know the picture where you draw a plane and then you draw a handle coming out, like a Riemann picture of a Riemann surface or something like that. It could be much shorter to go through the handle to get to that other place in proper distance. So that's called the wormhole. So now the idea of a closed time-like curve, they could be simultaneous in some frame when you produce them. The idea of making a closed time-like curve is to take one end of it, put it in your spaceship or whatever, and move at very high velocity. And because of the twin paradox, for that end, time goes elapses more slowly than it does for the other end. And after a while, this end is in the past, the causal past of that other end. And then that means that by traversing the wormhole, you could actually go into your own past. So that's an example. If you accepted that space-time, you would make a close, you would produce, create a closed time-like curve that wasn't there. Now, what's wrong with it? So the main thing wrong with it is probably that it's no one has ever found a consistent way of making the wormhole stay open long enough in order to traverse it. In fact, we know that if you assume an energy condition, then there's this topological censorship theorem, which forbids it. But there's also problems from quantum field theory. It's been proven that if you do that, there'll be a divergence in the stress tensor at some point, just at the moment when the closed time-like curve would have come into being. Then people have argued, how serious is that divergence? Will the Planck discrete, you know, can it be overcome and so on? But there are examples of actual inconsistencies in models of space-time that develop closed time-like curve. So in a sense, nature is reacting against us. I don't want to do this.
There's a nice example where you can see more explicitly what happens in 2 plus 1 gravity. I was telling this a long time ago, and with Roman Zakief, I read that are no closed time curves, but then some mathematicians came with a counter example. So what I did instead is I studied a 2 plus 1 dimensional universe, which you can, because you can write down the closed solutions to that, so you can write down exact solution, but I looked at Cauchy surfaces. If you have a Cauchy surface, then you are assuming that there can't be a closed time curve. So you can ask what happens if you work with Cauchy surfaces. You discover that the whole universe collapses to a point. It goes into a big shrink, and it happens very fast, just before the closed time curve opens up. Actually, the universe disappears altogether. So the closed time curve is somehow behind the big crunch, and that's what. But you can't a priori avoid that the universe you're sitting in might shrink to a point. You're out of luck, of course. And all your nice plans for the future will no longer go through. But this is quite difficult to exclude. such universe could be behind that big crunch could have as many closed time occurs as you want to be physically relevant. But it would be more convenient to be in a universe which doesn't shift to a point, then you can't have a closed time occur.
So I think the
third
use that.
Yeah, I was following Eric's comment on that whatever quantum gravity is, it should somehow explain or be compatible with ADS-CFT correspondence. But doesn't that then mean that quantum gravity has to be higher dimensional than 4? No?
What do you mean higher? Well, I mean, we were talking here about emergence of space-time. The question is, should we already decide in advance what the dimension of the space-time is that is going to emerge? Because, so the question is, I mean, clearly we live in four space-time dimensions. The question is, can we understand everything that's going on in the theory of gravity in four dimensions without assuming any additional dimensions? That's basically what your question is. I mean, ADS-CFT is a correspondence between a theory. I mean, we have various examples. Of course, one of them requires a five-dimensional picture with then a five-dimensional space time with a four-dimensional boundary. But we have other examples which are lower dimensional. Anyway, I do think that string theory has important clues in it, and it requires extra dimensions. Whether they are dimensions of the same sort that we are living in, clearly, I mean, in string theory, they're even not that they're compacted by or whatever. I mean, but I don't think that emergence of space-time can be studied just in the four-dimensional picture that we have right now of space in time without assuming anything else. I mean, clearly, I think there are more degrees of freedom needed, for instance, to explain black hole entropy. In string theory, we always make use of these extra dimensions. So there is some way in which they would play a role.
So I think, Stephen?
I just want to follow up on the discussion on closed time-like curves. Gerard, I'm a little surprised that you were so concerned about them as an advocate of superdeterminism, because I mean, essentially, a space-time with closed time-like curves is something that has a consistency constraint on it. On the data at a single time, it's going to be a non-local constraint conserved in some way over evolution. It looks like it's reminiscent of your Hunter conservation law. And, you know, the problem, the grandfather paradox, and this is related, it only really comes up if you assume a strong form of determinism. And you can, of course, not determinism, but free will. And if you just assume that you can certainly tell a consistent story with closed time-like curves about somebody coming, going back into the past and trying to kill their grandfather and not succeeding and being thwarted.
The question is, where's the beginning and where's the end of that book which contains that story? That,
well,
to me, is a true definition of time. The notion of time you use when you talk about closed time like curves, to me, is a phony definition of time. That's not real time.
Well, what about just a compactified in the time-like direction, Minkowski space-time?
Minkowski's
time?
Minkowski's time doesn't have to be causal time. It usually is. I believe it is. But you can imagine a universe where causal time is something else. And you can do what you say. You can make a closed time like curve, kill your grandfather, but the order of the causal order.
Not kill your grandfather. No, I'm saying that it's like chronology protection, except the idea really is that at any surface, what you call a Cauchy surface, you have an extra constraint on your initial data which guarantees that you won't kill your grandfather, that you have a self-consistent solution. So you produce a space of solutions in a way similar to what you're going to do in your model of the cellular automata.
So whatever the time variable is for these Cauchy surfaces, that's the real time variable.
Okay. I'll stop there.
Okay, just a second. There's actually also another reason why not having closed time-like curves is a nice thing, because if you actually want to look at causality as being, or causal structure as being the more fundamental ingredients, then the precise geometry of your space-time, then if you want to use those theorems by Hawking and Garrett, which tell you that the causal structure implies also the geometry of Hormel scales. And,
yeah, but the point is that you still have light cones.
I mean, that relies on their stable causality, which means you don't have any post-time that curves plus even a bit more than that. So, I mean, these theorems, they require the absence of closed time that occurs, plus the absence of closed time that occurs in even perturbed space times where you open up the light cones.
Yeah, but I have a question about, in fact, it's for, you know, people who have a model like you, Rob, and you, Eric. More generally, it's a question about causality. Here, I appreciate, you know, your point, Kara, that I think you're saying if you mess up with locality, you're going to mess up with causality. So I'm very reluctant to do that. And I think it's very true. Personally, I do want to mess up with. So I take it as a statement that you cannot mess up with locality without messing up with causality. And that's the challenge we're all facing. And one hand is to say, well, I don't want to do it.
But the question is whether you can have space-like separated events.
Yeah.
That means events where whatever happens there, is the order you use is irrelevant. You can have Cauchy surfaces with this order or Cauchy surfaces with that order.
Yeah. But in
but
so in specific...
That,
so
you want locality as an important element in the theory as well. If you don't care about such possibilities of
closure
surfaces, then I can imagine a theory without
locality. In some sense, I do. I'm just trying to say that it seems to me that the fundamental, you know, challenge of quantum gravity is that, like you know, challenging locality is challenging causality. And therefore, here we have a model, right? You tell me you have a model. So what hints do we have about how causality is somehow, you know, extended or challenged? I mean, ADS-CFT is a non-local model. You're on the boundary, and somehow what's inside is somehow something, you know, it's reconstructed. So what are the hints in this model today that we have about how do we deal with the modification
causality? For example, one of those surprises, I mean, you used the word locality before, so I'm going to focus that because I have an example where, you know, there was a case you know, you are working in a theory that is in higher dimensions, and there are these other objects around, their strings, their brain. But there was a certain constraint on a set of states and how much angular momentum or momentum in the internal space they could carry. And it was obvious that, well, I'm going at very high momentum, and so that means short wavelengths and something really exciting has to be happening at that scale. But after a while, or the surprise was that, no, that's not the way, it wasn't a surprise waiting in the UV. And in fact, it was an effect where when you went to high momenta, the thing that you thought was a small particle actually started to expand. And it turned into an infrared. I mean, it was simply that it was a big object now sitting in a finite space, and it could only get so big. And so rather than getting some exciting, you know, new effect at short distances, you found that it was actually an infrared. It was a simple explanation, but it lay sort of at large scales, not at small scales. So that, I mean, if it's not a challenge to locality, it's a hint that sometimes, you know, we're asking a question and we think we're looking for a particular answer, but in fact that the answer, you know, it's not what you expected.
So I guess if you extrapolate, here you're talking about this focus on a point, it's a space, right?
Yeah.
So I'm asking...
Well, it was something where you were looking at very high momentum and you thought you were focusing...
So now I'm asking if I kind of relativize this picture, it means that it's doing something on the time direction too. Like this you know, impossibility to locate. So what kind of, what is it doing? Like, you know, if it is doing something like that in the time direction, then I have to revise or upgrade. It gives me a hint about what causality is becoming. I mean,
Yeah, I mean,
I agree with you that it's a model where you have this
Right.
You get what you get. You get the local.
So I'm not sure if this is any better, but you know, it's the kind of again, when you're working with extended objects, we draw these interactions of you know, a pair of pants diagram where two loops. Mm-hmm. You can do string theory with your fingers here. Two loops come along and they form a single loop. You know, but when you draw that and you ask where did the interaction really happen, well, I did like that, and so it was obvious that it was when my fingers hit. That was an interaction. But if you think about it, if you just have the geometry of the world sheet, you're not really ever sure, or you can't really pinpoint. And so this is part of the problems that you know people got into when they were talking about string field theory. You know, you have to choose gauges and you make particular choices, but different choices, the interaction happens in different ways at different places in the embedded space. So again, I'm not sure that's a satisfactory example, but it's a hint that you know, these concepts aren't as rigid as perhaps we thought. I don't know if Eric has.
Yeah. Well, ADS-CT is an interesting example because the boundary, of course, has a well-defined time, and there we know everything is causal. The question is how do we have locality in the boat? And even if there's non-locality in the boat, we know that still it must be consistent because we can always go back to the boundary, and there we have all the causal relations that we normally have. And so then it's interesting to get into examples where things become sort of a little non-local from the, well, in some way, because they need these things can grow. There's something called also the UVIR correspondence in string theory. It means that there's a very deep connection between short distance behavior and the infrared behavior, and ADS-CFT shows this explicitly, because in order to get very close to the center of the ADS space, we have to go to the IR, the long wavelength properties of the CFT, which is a very non-local thing. And now the question is, we have these non-local objects on the boundary, but somehow they interact locally in the boat. I mean, this is a question where we have no full understanding of what's going on. But I think it's indeed an important hint about what is the difference maybe between causality, which is the causal relations we have on the boundary, and the locality that we have in the boat. And I don't think we have a full understanding there, but at least a model where we can try to study this.
But do you have hints to alleviate Gerard's concern? That is, you know, I appreciate that in the bulk, if you have non-locality, it's space-like non-locality, but there is certainly a certain amount of time-like non-locality. So, you know, how does the theory somehow seems to avoid this concern? Or maybe there's no clue to that.
I don't think we're very well, I mean, the examples we can work out generally are either static, where we have to use the same time that we have on the boundary in the boat. If we do dynamical questions and ask what is the time that we should use in the boat, I don't think we have a very good, string theories are not very good at reconstructing the boat on the boundary. There's still a lot of things to be honest.
I would like to say something or ask a related question to this. So, I mean, we saw that these closed time-like curves seem problematic, but also that this causation is important, so that it has like a direction of time. But I'm not so sure whether if one goes to microscopic scales, like to the Planck scale, whether we think that this causation should still hold. I mean, I personally do not think that it is so important that on a very small scale one can still speak of future and past and that things are only causally related.
Mm-hmm. So. I think we just disagree. And the fantasy that quantum gravity would be understood through the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is timeless, and which allows one to imagine that causality and time disappear at the fundamental scale, I just think has not been borne out by real results. I mentioned the difference between different kinds of matrix models and string theory. You can mention the success of causal dynamical triangulations which show the emergence of space-time when time is assumed, as opposed to the failure for Euclidean dynamical triangulation to show the emergence of space-time above two dimensions.
the success of causal sets, the variant of Raphael's causal sets that I worked on with Marina Cortez, energetic causal sets, where we get from causal structure an emergence of a Minkowskian space-time. But the causality of the temporal the causal order is assumed and non-emergent. All these different things and some other considerations that would bring us too far afield to talk about convince me that that causation and time in the sense of causal order is fundamental. And just to comment, I mean, Andre, you got a lot of response from you're bringing up closed timeline curves, but let me just mention a response. The fact that a theory is well verified as general relativity is doesn't mean that every feature of every solution has to be a feature of nature. There is just one universe, and the fact is that it is the way it is, and it's not like the others. So there's only at most one solution of the Einstein equation that describes the universe, and all the others are just of academic interest. And I think it's fairly easy to say, for the reasons that we were mentioning, that those solutions of the Einstein equation with closed harmonic curves are unstable and non-generic, and they're just they're nice things to pose on PhD exams and for academic mathematicians to write papers about, but they've got nothing to do with the description of nature.
Eric doesn't look convinced.
So I'd just like to ask, Gerard had this argument about the conservation laws to that would somehow explain this non-local business. And if I follow Niyayesh's comment that elliptic equations somehow embody conservation laws, then I could always separate my equations into hyperbolic, parabolic, and elliptic. And elliptic would be conservation laws. I could separate parabolic into hyperbolic and elliptic. So my question is, how can you see something that is actually non-local as opposed to something that comes from a conservation law or from some... Is there a way of saying that something is actually fundamentally non-local, or can you always explain it away as something coming from conservation laws plus some hyperbolic evolution?
I think the bottom line here is that we need models of what happens. As you know, the standard model of the element particles is started out as a model turning into a theory. And I think there's something very deep about that, that we may well have to do the same thing in Planck-length physics. First, try to make models that work. And when they work, we can check whether they agree with actual observations. We have the standard model today that has 25 ununderstood parameters in it. So if we can see whether they match with the predictions that a good theory should give us, but that's on a Planck scale, then whatever model we came up with works. So the question is, in this model, will there be causality, locality, and so on, or not? And I would find it very difficult to design models which have no locality, because that opens up the lid to an infinity of possibilities where I wouldn't be able to choose. Whereas if I would make, I would just make exactly so many constraints as possible to find any model at all without contradictions, and then only if really necessary, I would drop all those constraints. So causality and locality would be among the very last conditions I would drop. If someone tells me the world is not diffeomorphism invariant and general relativity doesn't hold exactly, I would say, fine, let's try that. Although if I would do this, I would drop a constraint on the theory, making it more difficult for myself to find the model. But if that would be the way, I wouldn't care too much. But throwing away locality would already be much, much more difficult. I want space-like separated things to be independent of each other. If I don't have that, I wouldn't understand nature's textbook
of laws of nature, and I wouldn't even know how to begin writing such a book. It would be an infinite book, and somehow we have our experience in physics. Physics is not infinite. We only need a finite number of constraints and a finite number of demands, and my model will be something we can work out in a finite number of steps. That would be the most successful theory we could come up with. So that's something we should try to fight for, which doesn't mean that we'll succeed. If we don't succeed, we will try the next thing. I would suggest throw out one demand at a time, but please don't throw away everything, because then for sure you won't find the right model. So it all becomes then a question of strategy. And a question of strategy, well, I just gave you my recipe for a strategy. I'm sure there will be as many strategies as there are physicists, and that's the way it should be. So let everybody try whatever they think is the best approach. I think the most rational approach and most comprehensible approach will be the most likely one to succeed first. But then, if everything else fails, you will try all the other options.
Any comments from the audience on this, or
not on the philosophy that was just given? I agree wholeheartedly with that philosophy. Now the comment, it's more of a question for clarification. People, there's been a lot of talk about locality and non-locality, and I think it can mean some slightly different things to different people. So I'm just curious, for those who spoke about it, what does it mean to you? One thing that it could mean is what Hera just essentially said, things that are space-like separation in some sense, it's not so easy to characterize quantum mechanically, but in some sense are independent of each other. Or it could mean that no effect jumps from one place in space-time to another without going through some continuous intermediate path. And those aren't the same thing, because it's possible for things to jump in a time, I think Lee or someone mentioned this, it's possible for things to jump in a time-like sense without violating this kind of space-like independence that you're talking about, but yet be non-local in the sense that there's no continuous propagation. So to make that, well, so I'm merely asking for clarification on that, but I want to say that I think that the non-locality, that there's a kind of, the second kind is a kind of non-locality that respects causality and respects the space-like independence. That I don't find threatening in the same way that the one that I think that some people were worried about would be, which is that, you know, faster than light or space-like transmission of information.
Okay.
I think I know what you are talking about, which is the causal sets where, due to Lorentz invariance, you need every now and then to make big excursions along the light column from one spot to a spot very far away. Because that's very far away in one Lorentz frame, but not in another Lorentz frame. So Lorentz invariance forces you to consider such interactions, and I know you are thinking along these lines with causal sets. But you could also argue that that actually is locality in disguise, because now you say, well, some effect has jumped from here to the Andromeda Nebula along a light cone. Well, that effect did follow a light cone. So it had, only if you say it stops in places in between just to refuel, then the whole thing becomes a local interaction again. So one could argue whether that really is non-locality, but as you say, that's a different notion of non-locality, which looks closer like repairable to replace by something which is local, but that has the same effect. And of course, in model building, we'll often encounter a situation that you can phrase the model in various equivalent ways. The physical effect will be the same, but the mathematics will look different. So the mathematics might look non-local in your eyes, it might look local in my eyes. So that's, of course, a situation we should also be aware of, that there may be multiple ways of formulating the same model.
I think there was a comment by
I just want to comment on this because it's something I thought about. The question, I think that both Raphael and I don't know his name. How you distinguish a theory with that's non-local in the sense of violating bell locality and the theory that has a kind of constraint that Gerard was discussing. And I think it's instructive to think about why we think about the causal structure, the so-called the light cone structure, as having anything to do with causation and locality in the first place. And I think it's because we typically regard the data on a Cauchy surface as spatially independent, right? We have local degrees of freedom. And so if we make a small change at one place, then we can ask about what parts of the solution in the future, in the past, have to change. But once you impose a constraint on the data on a space-like surface, such as this ontic constraint, then you can't make arbitrary changes at a point. You know, it's another way of saying that the changes at a point are not independent of the changes of the data elsewhere. So it's very difficult to analyze locality and causality when you have such a constraint. You really have to think very hard about, I think, what you mean. What do you mean by signaling? What do you mean by causality? What do you mean by locality? If you can't just do something here and ponder the effects of a local change, of a free local change, there are no free local changes. They're always associated with something happening, not happening, but something being different somewhere else. Then it's the whole notion of a locality comes into question.
That was my question.
I know. That's why I was trying to address your question.
Okay.
To respond to both Enrique and Raphael, I'm going to respond to Gerard's call for model. So let me give you two models that to me are models of what I mean by non-locality with causality. One which will be less familiar is one we made with Marina Cortez, which we call energetic causal sets, where the fundamental objects or events, they're related by causal relations, which are well-defined, so causation. Causality is well-defined. And intrinsic, there's energy. Unlike Raphael's causal sense, there's energy and momentum, which are intrinsic degrees of freedom. But there's no x, mu, there's no t, there's no space-time degrees of freedom. But nonetheless, when we study, that we have a certain dynamics, and we study the stationary phase approximation, there emerges a space-time coordinate, which emerges only in a certain semi-classical approximation. So in that sense, there's no space originally. There is causation. There are energy, momentum, and other variables. But space-time is really something which emerges later. Therefore, locality emerges later. It's not part of the fundamental laws. And therefore, if locality emerges, and it's worth anything to say that locality and space emerge, there must be defects if there are defects. So that's one model. The other model is the one that I mentioned in response to Eric, which is the matrix models for string theory and light cone gauge. You originally have a picture of n objects, so-called D0 grains, interacting with each other through matrix degrees of freedom. There's no embedding in space. It's just the matrix degrees of freedom. The fact that there's a matrix means that all the D grains are in interaction with all the other D grains. So everybody's talking to everybody. There's no notion of sequestering or locality. But nonetheless, there's a large limit where physics of gravitons and other global fields propagating in an emergent space-time does emerge. We quite explicitly discussed and computed. So I think these are two models among several models which explicitly realize what I mean when I say that locality is emergent in space.
So I think we've now amply discussed locality and causality. I actually wanted to add to another topic, namely complexity and emergence of scales. But I think so we're already like 1 hour and 20 minutes into this organized discussion, and I think I would allow people who are now tired to break up and go to the chaotic discussions. But yeah, whoever's interested in continuing the discussion can, of course, stay here. And of course, also for the panel members, thanks a lot. And if you want to stay on for discussions, then.